This time on your weekly constitutional.
The ultimate goal of Lincoln, not only for Tennessee, but for the rest of the seceded states, is to return them to the Union. And Lincoln did not view the Union as having been dissolved. Instead, what he called the practical relation of the seceded states to the federal Union needed to be restored.
You've heard of something called Reconstruction, which followed the Civil War. It was a time when formerly seceded states were readmitted to the Union one by one. But how exactly did that happen? What was required? Well, attorney and historian Sam Elliott is here today to tell us all about how the great state of Tennessee won its readmission. It's a long, difficult, and fascinating tale. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and this week it's about reconstructing Tennessee.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
I have the great honor, in addition to my teaching duties, of being the associate director of something called the Abraham Lincoln Institute for the Study of Leadership and Public Policy. It's sponsored by Lincoln Memorial University. It makes sense. I mean, that's who the university's named after, right? One of the marquee events that happens every year through the Lincoln Institute and is held at my law school, the Duncan School of Law, is something called the R. Gerald McMurtry Memorial Lecture. Every year, a scholar or a lawyer or perhaps both comes and speaks to us and tells us about some aspect of Abraham Lincoln's leadership, some other aspect of his personal biography or history. And these lectures are just absolutely fascinating. This year's lecture, the 2017 lecture, particularly fascinated me. It was given by a fellow by the name of Sam Elliott. He's an attorney and historian from Chattanooga, former president of the Tennessee Bar Association, really nice fellow. And he spoke about a subject that I don't know enough about, and I suspect you don't either. How exactly did the seceded states get readmitted to the United States at the end of the Civil War? It wasn't an easy process, and it wasn't simple. And in Tennessee, at least, it involved a great deal of politics and a very stubborn man by the name of Andrew Johnson. I think you'll enjoy this story just as much as I did.
Well, my name's Sam Elliott. I'm like the actor, but I don't have his looks or his money. And I am an attorney in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
And you're also a historian, right?
I am. I have just released my fifth book.
Five books on top of a law practice.
Yes.
And tell us about it.
Well, I have been interested in the Civil War since I was a small boy. And at one point, about 21 years ago, I decided I would try to write on it. Mm-hmm. All of us lawyers are frustrated writers or teachers or a combination of both.
Uh-huh.
And so I sat down and wrote a biography of a fellow by the name of Alexander P. Stewart, who's...
A.P. Stewart. Tell me more about him.
He was a corps commander, a division commander and a corps commander in the Confederate Army of Tennessee. And his statue's in front of the Hamilton County Courthouse in Chattanooga. He was not from Chattanooga, but he was one of the commissioners who formed the Chickamauga-Chattanooga National Military Park.
Really?
Yes.
I've always loved that battlefield. In fact, I went there some years ago, and I still vividly recall that in the visitor center of that time, and this is probably close to 20 years ago, they had two television sets side by side to show the effect of the repeating rifle for
yes.
the Union forces. And they showed a Confederate soldier reloading his muzzle loader and maybe getting off three shots in a minute, and then 15 or so shots with a repeater.
Closer to 21.
That really, 21 yes. shots in a minute.
Yes.
And apparently it was not available through the Army, but the relatives of the Union soldiers were sending them to their sons.
Well, actually, and the commander of that unit was a fellow by the name of John T. Wilder, who mm-hmm. later was actually, he was from Indiana, Greencastle, Indiana. But he later was the mayor of Chattanooga.
Really?
After the war, a number of Northerners saw the natural resources and the potential for development in East Tennessee, and quite a few of them came to Chattanooga and to the East Tennessee area, and Wilder was one of them. But he learned of this repeating rifle and actually went out and went to bankers in his hometown, got the money, went out and bought the rifles. And then his men signed a little promissory note that they'd pay back for the rifles, and that's how they were equipped. And they were 7-shot repeaters,
right?
And had a tremendous amount of firepower, as you might imagine.
Yes, and in fact, it was one of the reasons that the Union did pretty well at Chickamauga.
Well, that was one of the few units that held on at Chickamauga. Actually, right. Chickamauga was one of the few Confederate victories.
Yeah, I should have been more specific, but yes. That unit that had the rifles.
Yes, they were able to hold on and hold the hill that they were holding when all the units around them were sort of melting away.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful battlefield, too.
Yes.
Beautifully preserved. So you got interested in Chickamauga. You got interested in A.P. Stewart. And you wrote a book about him.
And then I next edited a book, an autobiography of a Confederate chaplain by the name of Charles Todd Quintard. I'm a graduate of the University of the South, my undergraduate degree in
history.
Suwannee, that's correct. And Quintard had a lot to do with saving Suwannee after the Civil War in the sense that it was given a large gift of land that was going to be lost in 1867 unless a school got up and running. And so he built a log cabin and started teaching classes and therefore saved that land for Suwannee. But he was a very well-connected, both a medical doctor and then later an Episcopal priest, and traveled in the highest levels of society, and that translated into traveling in the highest levels of the command structure of the Confederate Army in that area, the Army of Tennessee, and therefore his autobiography and his diary both have some significant insights as to the thinking, especially at the latter stages of the war, of mm-hmm. the Confederate High Command. So very useful book if you're into that sort of thing. And then my next book was a biography of Isham G. Harris, who was the governor of Tennessee at the time Tennessee joined the Confederacy and later rehabilitated himself to the point of being a 20-year serving United States senator.
That is rehabilitation.
Absolutely. And then after that, I edited a book of journal articles that the Tennessee Historical Society asked me to put into a book in order to commemorate the sesquicentennial of the Civil War. And then just in the last month or so, my next book, a biography of John C. Brown, who was the first Redeemer governor of Tennessee after Reconstruction and was a Confederate general as well, and then later a railroad lawyer. Has just come out.
Well, finally, we come back to the law. I don't know how you yes. practice law, which is itself a very, very demanding career. And on top of that, write all of these books and still manage to find time to sleep. But we're so very happy that a historian of your prominence was able to come and join us for this year's McMurtry Lecture. And it was a fascinating tale that you told. Could you share it with everyone?
In the course of my work with Governor Harris and later with John C. Brown, I started focusing on both the political and the legal angles of what happened to Tennessee in the time period from 1861 to 1870. And, of course, during that time, you have 5 years of the Civil War, but you also have legal issues coming out of the issue of secession, the issue of being readmitted to the Union, and mm-hmm. who gets to vote, and how do we structure the government and that sort of thing. And so
you said something at the outset of your presentation, and you just reminded me of it. You started this like a lot of Civil War buffs do. That is the battles, the guns,
correct.
The excitement, all of which is fine. It's all great. And lots of people love reading and writing about that. But then you segued into something that personally I find far more interesting. And that's all the politics that lead up to the war, that were occurring during the war and even afterward. And so this was a really fascinating angle that you took. But please continue.
Well, legally, in 1861, there was a very highly debated and unsettled legal question as to whether or not secession was constitutional or not. Was the Federal Union, was it a compact of the states, which the people who advocated secession argued that it was, or was it a compact of the people as a whole? Mm-hmm. And ironically, since we're in Tennessee and talking about Tennessee, Andrew Jackson took the position that it was a compact of the people as a whole, because how does the preamble of the Constitution start?
Sure does. We the people.
We the people.
And there are some scholars who say that was very deliberate.
Yes.
They wanted to make sure this was not something done by the states.
But to continue on, the It was a highly contested issue, and as a matter of fact, it wasn't really settled, at least in the courts, until 1869 with the Texas versus White case of the United States Supreme Court. But in 1861, we didn't have that. And so when Tennessee, when the quote secessionists in Tennessee decided they were going to approach it from a legal standpoint, they adopted what is known as a Declaration of Independence. And they said, we are not we're not giving an opinion on the quote abstract doctrine of secession. Instead, we are invoking our right to alter, abolish, or reform our government, which is a right that is contained or was contained and continues to be contained in the Tennessee Constitution, Article 1, Section 1, which effectively creates a right of revolution.
Yeah, and which borrows language from the Declaration of Independence itself.
Well, and as a matter of fact, and of course, then you get into the issue, well, is it a true revolution or is it an attempted revolution? And of course, the Civil War proved that it was an attempted revolution and therefore no more than a rebellion. But at any rate, that constitutional right survived in the Tennessee Constitution of that time and, like I said, survives today. So when the Confederate government in Tennessee is effectively dissolved by federal military action in 1862, 1863, and 1864, the issue becomes one of how does Tennessee regain its civilian government? Because when the Confederate Army was initially defeated, President Lincoln sent Andrew Johnson, who was a Tennessee senator who refused to secede with the state, so to speak, stayed with the Union. And so President Lincoln sent him to Tennessee as a military governor. And the ultimate goal of Lincoln, not only for Tennessee, but for the rest of the seceded states, is to return them to the Union. And Lincoln did not view the Union as having been dissolved. Instead, what he called the practical relation of the seceded states to the federal Union needed to be restored. And Lincoln looked for ways to do that. And he came up with what I guess historians call the 10% plan at the end of 1863, which basically said if 10% of the voters from 1860, the 1860 presidential election, if they signed an oath and formed a government, then he would recognize it as the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And that oath was basically that we're going to abide by the results of the Emancipation Proclamation, and I'm going to, from now on, be loyal to the United States. So it was two very simple concepts. Andrew Johnson was faced with something like that in Tennessee, and he decided that he needed a little more stringent oath. And one of the things we discussed in the talk was the formulation of what Andrew Johnson called, or what people later came to call, not the amnesty oath, but the damnesty oath. And the reason it was called the damnesty oath is not only did you have to agree to be loyal to the United States, but that you had to, quote, ardently desire suppression of the present insurrection and rebellion against the government of the United States, the success of its armies, and the defeat of all those who opposed them. And the reason it was a damnesty oath is that a number of people in Tennessee had relatives who still supported the Confederacy.
Sure.
And so you were taking an oath that you ardently desired their defeat, their demise, and maybe even their deaths.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking today with Sam D. Elliott, who was the McMurtry Lecturer this year, the lecturer at the R. Gerald McMurtry Memorial Lecture at Lincoln Memorial University. We're speaking about reconstructing Tennessee. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Sam Elliott.
I feel the need for a quiz. How about you?
I feel an urge here.
Feeling the urge?
My life is a series of quizzes, Stuart. Uh-huh. Great to see you. How are you?
I'm doing extremely well. That's interesting. Your life is a series of quizzes. My life is just a series of urges.
I should say it's a series of pop quizzes.
Pop quizzes. Okay, then. Do we have a contestant to take our pop quiz?
My name is John Corbin from Cody, Wyoming.
Cody, Wyoming. Wow. Cody, I don't know if I've met anybody from Wyoming. How many of you are there? Like six?
Pretty close.
Are there cowboys in your town?
Yes.
Real cowboys.
Quite literally, yeah.
That, like, really go out and herd cows and stuff. And
yeah,
rope
and there's
them and
also
tie
fake
them
ones
and...
that do, like, gun shows and stuff like that in the middle of the day, because our town was established by Buffalo Bill Cody. And so we also have a rodeo that runs every night from June 1st through August 31st.
Every night?
Every night. We're the rodeo capital of the world.
So if you pay your taxes, do they give you a hat?
No.
He's wearing a hat. That's why you asked, right?
No, but I mean like a cowboy hat.
Oh, okay. No, well, I guess the answer to that is no. Yeah. I'm just curious, okay? I want your honest opinion. Rodeo clowns, good, bad?
Good for the bull rider, bad for the audience.
And on that creepy note.
Okay. Do we have a question?
We do. Well, all right. So I'm going to give you a question, and I've got good news for you. There's two answers here. One is yes, and the other is no.
Oh, wonderful.
So keep that in mind as you listen to the question.
You got a 50% chance.
If you agree to testify at a trial, can you plead the Fifth Amendment on cross-examination? Can you plead the Fifth on cross-examination if you agree to testify at a trial? Yes or no?
That's really hard.
That's a tough question. But think about it for a moment. Ask yourself, what's the purpose of cross-examination?
Well, the purpose of cross-examination is to be able to flesh out further information.
Right. You know? Or a lawyer might say to test the veracity of a witness. So if you're my witness and I ask you questions, 10 questions, and Doug is opposing counsel, and he gets a chance to get up and cross-examine you, he's going to try to, you know, test and see if your answers were truthful and reliable and all the rest of that good stuff. So the question is, if you've agreed to come in and answer my 10 questions, can you then turn around and refuse to let Doug ask you his questions?
The hang-up that I'm finding here is that the accused, because cross-examination is usually, I would imagine it's from the defendant side of the court. And so if you have already answered questions from like the district attorney or the county attorney, then you would need to be cross-examined. However, nothing makes you say anything. You can agree to show up, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to answer.
Well, say you agreed questions. And actually answered questions. You're agreeing to answer questions, not just to show up, but you agree to answer questions, and you answer questions on direct examination. Can you then plead the Fifth on cross?
I believe you can, because you can self-incriminate by answering certain questions. So I guess yes.
The answer is no.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry. No.
I was leaning no, too.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, lean farther.
I hope I didn't mislead you there.
How does that work? If you could self-incriminate, you don't have to self-incriminate yourself.
Right, but the decision needs to be made when you decide whether to testify or not. So, for example, you'll see lots and lots of criminal defendants refuse to take the stand, even though they know the jury wants to hear from them. I mean, it's true. I mean, if you think of yourself, if you're on a jury and someone's being accused of a crime, you want to hear that person tell you, I didn't do it. But if that person gets up there and says, I didn't do it, then the opposing counsel, in that case the prosecutor, gets to cross-examine, and then it's too late. I mean, you can't get up there and give one half the story is what it comes down to.
See, I think there's a thing here.
There's a thing?
You lead the guys astray. That's why we don't come up here.
No. Is that what it is? Oh, okay. It must be my fault. I'm very sorry.
You're exactly right on that one. Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah, you are. Yeah. You can't just say...
He's heading down the rabbit hole.
Uh-huh.
You can't say, I'm absolutely willing to testify, and then you start testifying, and then on cross you say, well, you know, actually, I don't want to incriminate myself now. Because it only gives you, I mean, it's really not fair for both sides. It's an equity issue.
It's an equity issue. It's a truth-finding issue. I mean, the function of any court, think about this. Why do we even have trials? The reason we have trials is to suss out the truth, is to find the truth. That's the most fundamental function of any court of law, whether it's a civil case or a criminal case. Now, sometimes we don't find the truth, and we actually have privileges, like the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, that get in the way of that truth-finding function.
Yeah, it's about immunity.
It is. You're immune from it, but you can't half do it. You can't get in and give your half of the truth and then refuse to have that testimony tested under cross-examination, which is why, again, you see a lot of criminal defendants refuse to take the stand on the advice of their attorneys.
Yeah, that's right, because it's not because the attorney won't ask you the right questions. It's that the other attorney might not ask you
exactly.
The right
questions. The other attorney is going to test that, exactly right. Yeah. And, of course, you can't just get up there and lie either. A lot of criminal defendants probably are tempted to do that, but you can't do that either. And, again, that would this also goes to that. I mean, a lot of criminal defendants would take the stand and might very well lie, knowing that their lie is not going to be tested. So for all those reasons, if you want to assert the Fifth Amendment, you do it before you take the stand.
From the beginning.
From the beginning. Well, thank you very much, Doug. I appreciate it. That was a good question.
Thanks so much. Always great to see you.
Well, thank you very much for playing, and thank you, Doug.
Absolutely. It's the Constitution. I read it for the Articles.
Now it's time to continue our discussion with Sam D. Elliott, the featured speaker at this year's 2017 McMurtry Lecture at the Duncan School of Law. Sam was telling us before the break about the Reconstruction of Tennessee, about its readmission to the Union, and about the requirement that former Confederates take something called an amnesty oath, or, as it was reformulated by the military governor, Andrew Johnson, the damnesty oath.
Well, now, there are two possible circumstances for someone taking this oath, at least. One of them are people who have always been loyal and who have no problem taking the oath. Others are those who had been Confederates or had had sympathies and further divided into those who maybe had second thoughts about that now, or those who were simply lying about it. And so I guess there's a range of possibilities here, but it wasn't that unrealistic to think that there would be a lot of loyal people here, because there were a lot of loyalists in Tennessee, weren't there?
Well, there certainly were a lot of loyalists in East Tennessee. We're in Knoxville as we speak, and Knoxville was a very pro-Union town. A lot of Upper East Tennessee was pro-Union. As you went further south, there were especially towns along the railroad, Chattanooga, Athens, Cleveland, had pockets of Confederate sympathy. If you got up to where Kingsport is now, Sullivan County, there was that's of course contiguous to Virginia, so you had some Confederate sympathy there. But primarily, East Tennessee was a Unionist area.
So it was reasonable to think that there might very well be 10% of the population that could take the oath with no problem at all and would then form the core of a new state government.
The problem for Andrew Johnson was, though, if you had 10% of the people taking Lincoln's milder oath, which basically said, I'm loyal to the Constitution and the government of the United States, and I'm living with the Emancipation Proclamation, then you really can have some rebels sneak in and take control of the government because they have voting rights by taking that very mild oath.
A little too easy.
Well, and especially since, and we discussed this in the course of the discussion, too, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't apply in Tennessee.
Yeah.
So if you're supporting the Emancipation Proclamation and you're giving an oath that you're doing that, you're really not saying much because it's not applicable to Tennessee at that
time. It doesn't mean much. It's not like you're with the emancipation idea.
Correct.
Okay, so what did Andrew Johnson do about this? He had this much more strict, harsh damnesty oath. And was that okay? I mean, you've got Lincoln saying one thing and you've got Johnson saying another.
Well, because there were those who didn't like that stricter damnesty oath, they approached President Lincoln. They said, what about this? And Lincoln basically said that the damnesty oath was entirely satisfactory to him and that in his mind there was no conflict between the two oaths. Hmm. And basically, at the time Lincoln did the 10% plan, he said, you know, this is the plan that I'm recognizing, but that doesn't mean that I'm not going to recognize other plans as well. And certainly Johnson's plan fit him.
So he was making a floor, not a ceiling.
Yes.
You got to do at least my oath, but if you, in your state, you want to do a stricter oath, well then, go ahead.
Correct.
Okay.
And then there was the issue that Lincoln's oath was premised on his pardon power as president. In other words, he could grant amnesty through the constitutional power to pardon that he had. And there was a distinction made between his oath and the damnesty oath in the sense that Lincoln's oath merely granted you amnesty. You weren't going to be prosecuted by the federal government for Confederate sympathies or anything.
Right.
But for the power to vote, you had to take the damnesty oath.
I see. Okay, so there are levels of oath taking going on here.
Correct. Johnson held local elections in March of 1864, and they didn't go very well. And there's some thought that the damnesty oath had something to do with it, because you didn't. And by not going well, I meant that they didn't have a very large turnout.
Mm-hmm.
And the point was is that a number of people didn't take the damnesty oath to be able to vote because they felt it conflicted with them. Johnson didn't care. His point was to keep treason from the ballot box, so to speak.
And that was something that was really went through your whole discussion, is that, you know, today, even today, people will talk about the Civil War delicately. And you rarely hear the T word, treason. But they were unapologetic about it then. I mean, the Union people, especially Johnson in this case, felt that the Confederates were traitors, that they were waging war against the United States, that they'd killed a lot of U.S. soldiers. And Johnson, it seems, was intent on punishing them.
Yeah. And you know, certainly as the Union armies began to take control of the war, they certainly had that right to characterize it as treason. Of course, if you were a Confederate, you could argue, well, you know, secession's not unconstitutional. And so what am I being a traitor to?
Right. In fact, if you've already declared yourself no longer a citizen of the United States, how can you be committing treason?
Exactly.
So treason's sort of in the eye of the beholder.
Exactly.
But it is the one crime that's defined in the Constitution, and waging war against the United States is the standard.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. At any rate, when you get into the elections in the fall of 1864, and Johnson is tapped as Lincoln's running mate because Lincoln wants to run not as a Republican, but as on the, quote, National Union platform. So he selects the most prominent war Democrat, or one of the most prominent war Democrats, and that's Andrew Johnson. And Johnson is still trying to bring Tennessee into line, and he keeps prescribing, and his Confederates, so to speak, or his allies in Tennessee, keep prescribing more stringent oaths. And there are versions of the Damnesty Oath. The next version of the Damnesty Oath says that I will cordially oppose all armistices or negotiations for peace with rebels in arms until the Constitution of the United States and all laws and proclamations made in pursuance thereof shall be established over all people of every state and territory. The problem with that is that you are asking someone to take an oath to oppose peace with the Confederacy, and yet, in order to be able to vote, and yet the people who are, the man who is running against Lincoln, George B. McClellan, is actually got a peace plank in his platform. So you're actually taking an oath that you're going to oppose peace, and yet to vote for McClellan, you're voting for a peace plank. And so that didn't go very well either.
The modern analogy that occurs to me is if you go back a couple of presidential elections, if you required your voters to assert, I will not support health care reform as a condition of voting.
Right.
And of course, that was the Democratic platform a few years back. And I guess still is to some extent. And so, yeah, so you're basically excluding Democrats from the voting register is what you're doing with that oath.
Absolutely.
The Democrats of that day.
The Democrats of that day, absolutely. Right. So what happens in the end is that after that election, then there is the major move to restore civil government to Tennessee. And you have two factions. You have a more, quote, radical faction that wants to move quickly and to really cement the gains of the Civil War, proclaim emancipation, keep rebels from voting up to 15 years after the war, that sort of thing. And then you have a more conservative group that if there's going to be emancipation, it needs to be gradual, and you know, we need to gradually confer rights upon the freedmen rather than, you know, in one fell swoop, that sort of thing. And there's sort of a contest between the two of them, and there is an effort to organize a convention to decide what to do next. And there is a convention in early January of 1865, and the more conservative group says, hey, let's use this convention in order to select delegates for a true constitutional convention to address these issues. later on. And the men who are already at the convention say, there's no reason why we can't be the convention in order to propose to the electorate these constitutional changes that need to go into effect. And there is a charge that the fast-tracked convention, so to speak, the one that the radicals want to do, is irregular. And, of course, that's the title of the talk that I gave today about you cannot get back without some irregularity.
Uh-huh.
And Andrew Johnson basically says, now, you cannot get back in the present chaos and disorder without some irregularity. Some will say that if you are the irregular, the people will not sustain you. But he says, where is your law now? Lincoln may be charged with irregularity, but if he saves the government by it, who can find fault? The ultimate practical point of all this is you've got to start somewhere and getting things back to normal. And so, ironically, to justify the irregularity, again, they go back to Article 1, Section 1 of the Tennessee Constitution, which basically says you can alter, reform, change the government however the people see fit. And so they propose these constitutional amendments, notwithstanding the irregularity of this constitutional convention, and it's ratified by the people, and it is recognized by the courts. More importantly, and ultimately, and as the courts even say, and by the courts I mean the Tennessee Supreme Court, ultimately what the deal is that the federal military power has reconquered Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And because Lincoln and Johnson are backed by that federal military power in Tennessee, whatever irregularity there was, because the result is recognized by the people and it's backed by the military power, it becomes the law.
Yep, and you had a really compelling picture of all the Union troops lined up in Nashville at the end of the war, and that's why this Constitution became regular.
Absolutely.
Exactly. I will sometimes make the point in my constitutional law class that we can talk about all these lofty principles, and we can talk about this federal power or that state power, but the ultimate power of any government is physical force. It's a sad fact of life, but that is why it's government that has the armies.
Well, another way of characterizing it is a monopoly of force.
Yes, in many respects, if you think of the government as a whole, who has the guns and is empowered to use them, it would be the Army, the Navy, the Marines, and then the police and the other law enforcement agencies. And now, of course, in this country, we have the Second Amendment, et cetera, and we don't have a disarmed populace. But the only entity, broadly speaking, that is authorized to use force on a regular basis is the government.
And that's why the Confederacy failed,
mm-hmm.
because they attempted a revolution, and because their guns did not outrange the Union guns, so to speak, it only became a rebellion rather than a revolution.
Right. To the victor go the spoils and the ability to characterize exactly what happened or to declare it constitutional or not.
Correct.
You mentioned the Texas versus White case, and I had the privilege of speaking earlier than you today. I was the first speaker. And Texas versus White is fascinating. Could you share a little bit about that case with us?
Well, I'm sure I'm not as familiar of it with you.
Well, I suspect
as
you are. You're the historian, but please.
But you know, the issue after the Civil War, and there's many, many cases in Tennessee on this issue as to if a action was taken while the government of a state was under Confederate control, was it legal after the Civil War? And Texas versus White addressed a facet of that. I don't remember exactly what the facts of it were.
Well, I'll fill it in then, because I just happened to be looking at it. Texas only came into the Union in the 1840s, right? It was declared independence from Mexico. You know, remember the Alamo, all of that, a few years as an independent Lone Star State. Then eventually came in, but there were issues to be negotiated, including some boundary disputes. And basically what happened is the federal government paid off Texas to the tune of $5 million to settle these boundary disputes. But it paid off Texas in the form of what were effectively promissory notes that matured over 14 years. They were technically called coupon bonds. But basically it was $5 million that was redeemable. And in fact, they were bearer bonds, so they could be sold immediately by Texas if they wanted to. And while Texas was still in the Union, it did sell some of these, perfectly legal. Some of them got redeemed, or at least the interest was paid on them. But then when the secession came around in 1861, they still had a lot of these bonds. And the Confederate government sold off some of these bonds to speculators late in the war in exchange for war material.
Then, of course, the Reconstruction government comes in, the provisional government, and that government of Texas tries to claim that the bond sales were illegal, so give us back our bonds. And then, of course, the Supreme Court had to consider the whole question that you just raised. Were those actions appropriate? Were they constitutional? What was the status of Texas during the war? And then, of course, ultimately, was the secession constitutional? Please, what did they decide?
Well, they decided that secession, of course, was unconstitutional.
Right.
In the sense, and you go back to what Lincoln said or the Tennessee Supreme Court said in another context, that the true view, the constitutional view of the Union is that it is indestructible. Mm-hmm. And therefore, even though the Confederate states purported to leave the Union, they actually never did because they legally could not.
In fact, Lincoln goes all the way back to the Articles of Confederation, which were perpetual. And then he references the preamble to the Constitution. We're here to make a more perfect union. And he said in his first inauguration speech, how can it be more perfect if it's less permanent? So, of course, the union is permanent and indestructible. What I've always found amusing is that the single case in all the U.S. Supreme Court canon that decides the issue of secession decided it 4 years after the even more seminal case of Lee versus Grant, which was decided at Appomattox. In a way, it seems like a an unnecessary and a moot point at that stage. But as you point out, it was a very significant sort of mop-up question. You know, what was the status of all the things that happened during the rebellion?
And I have heard this, and I can't say that I'm an expert on it, but I have heard that one of the reasons that perhaps Jefferson Davis's treason trial was not pushed to the maximum, he eventually was released, was the fact that if it went to trial, there was some legal issue as to whether or not he was truly guilty of treason because of this fact that secession could constitutionally have been permissible.
Remarkable legal issues that surround the Civil War, and you illuminated one that I had never really thought deeply about, and that is how exactly does a seceded state get back into the Union? And channeling Andrew Johnson, you said it does so irregularly, at least sometimes. So that was a great presentation today, Sam. We really appreciate you coming down and talking to us, and maybe you'll come back sometime.
I'd love to do so, Stuart. Thank you.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've just finished a really fun conversation with Sam D. Elliott, a historian and lawyer from Chattanooga, Tennessee, who was this year's R. Gerald McMurtry Memorial Lecture speaker. After the break, we'll speak with another guy who was at that same presentation, a guy you've heard from before and will probably hear from again, my good friend, Dr. Charles Hubbard. Stick around. And now it's time to hear from Dr. Charles Hubbard, who's not only the resident expert on Abraham Lincoln at Lincoln Memorial University, but also the executive director of the Abraham Lincoln Institute for the Study of Leadership and Public Policy. Charlie and I work very closely together at the Institute, and indeed we worked very hard on organizing this year's 2017 R. Gerald McMurtry Memorial Lecture. But we expanded it. We didn't just have the one-hour lecture we've had in the past. We added a couple of extra hours to it so that we could offer CLE, or Continuing Legal Education credit, to area lawyers. And we tried to focus not just on Abraham Lincoln, but on ethics and some of the ethical dilemmas that Lincoln faced when he was in office. And that's what Charlie is going to tell us about now. Charlie, welcome back to the show. Just recently, we were talking about why Lincoln saved the Union. That was a great episode. But then just recently, we did something again together. We did the McMurtry Lecture, and you gave a fantastic presentation on Lincoln and his ethics. Could you summarize it for us?
What I tried to do was explain or suggest that Lincoln was confronted with a significant dilemma when he became president, an ethical dilemma, that is, between his commitment to the rule of law and the strict interpretation of the Constitution, which he had always was very outspoken in support of, both of those things. And then he suddenly found himself confronted with the Civil War, with a rebellion, an insurrection, without the authority to carry out certain necessary maneuvers that he had to do. So he had to make up his mind whether or not he could stay within a strict interpretation of the law as he wanted to do, or whether he could prosecute the rebellion aggressively.
Yeah, and his problem was compounded, if I understand correctly, because Congress was not even in session when the Confederates fired on Fort Sumter, so he was kind of all by his lonesome there for a while.
Well, he in a sense he was. Of course, he had a cabinet was still in formation, and was still made up, as Doris Kearns Goodwin has written in her book, The Team of Rivals. They didn't like each other, and they were not on the same page. But, yes, that's true. And one of the things that Lincoln did was postpone. He called for the Congress to be reconvened, but he decided to do it in July rather than in June. He postponed it for a month, and during the month of June, he went about carrying out a number of what we might call extraordinary authoritative decisions.
Well, wait a minute. That changes the story a little bit, because I was saying he was there by himself and he had to act in the absence of Congress, but you just told me that he put off bringing Congress back.
Oh, that's right. That's right. He postponed it. He called them back in July.
Uh-huh.
During the month of May and June, he made a number of decisions he was not authorized to do.
And he did it deliberately.
He called for 75,000. Yes, 75,000 volunteers. Well, the President of the United States is not authorized to do that.
No, Article 1 gives Congress the power to raise armies and navies.
That's right, and certainly to set the number.
Right.
Now, he does have command of the standing army, which at that time was microscopic by comparison to what it wound up being before the war was over. But he also authorized the Secretary of the Treasury to expend public funds, Treasury money, to equip those troops. And he's not supposed to do that. That's Congress. You have to have an appropriation from Congress to do that.
That's a huge, huge issue. That is something that is strictly within Congress's purview. This is a serious no-no.
Oh, absolutely. And how about when troops were Union troops, these volunteers he called for, tried to get through the city of Baltimore, coming from Boston to defend Washington, which was sort of isolated and surrounded by rebels, I should say. Lincoln was concerned that the city needed to be defended, so he called for the troops from Boston to come, volunteers to come and defend the city. And when they tried to come through Baltimore to transfer the trains, they were assaulted by rebel sympathizers. And Lincoln decided, while some of these local authorities in Baltimore were literally recruiting Confederate volunteers for the Confederate Army.
Oh, my.
And so Lincoln decides that I've got to do something to stop this. So to do that, he arrests a number of people, including the sheriff and eventually the mayor of the city. And he arrests them. And then they ask for, they petition for a writ of habeas corpus. And Lincoln denies them release. And they go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says, you have to release these people. Roger Taney, the Chief Justice, says you have to release these people or charge them. Lincoln says, I'll do better than that. I'll just suspend the habeas corpus, the right of habeas corpus.
Now, I'm laughing, but I'm laughing because, of course, this is not a current issue. If this were a current issue, it would be a very serious matter for us to discuss. But it was serious back then, too. Habeas corpus is an ancient writ. It comes from the common law, and it's specifically protected in the Constitution. Only Congress is supposed to suspend
it. Congress was not in session.
Right. And I guess Lincoln...
Now, what Lincoln does is he tells all of the critics, including members of his cabinet, who raised questions about this, particularly the Secretary of the Treasury, saying, I don't have the authority to spend this money. Lincoln said, well, when Congress reconvenes, they will approve everything we've done. And sure enough, Congress did approve most everything that Lincoln did during that period before they convened. They approved what he did. And so later on, what this leads us around to talking about, as we talked about the other day, was does Lincoln do these things with the expectation that Congress is going to approve it? And does that really violate the law? Or should he have waited for Congress to approve his actions before he took the actions?
Or at the very least, should he have brought Congress back earlier, or at least on time, rather than delaying their return?
Well, yeah. Actually, yes, he could have brought them back sooner. And did he do that on purpose?
Mm-hmm.
So Lincoln didn't particularly, he was not fond of Congress throughout most of the war. Congress gave him some difficult times and objected to a lot of the things he was doing because they were trying to provide oversight of the presidency, and he didn't like that.
Right. And I guess he justified.
So one of his great reliefs was when Congress was not in session.
I think most presidents would be relieved when Congress isn't in session. Of course, these days Congress is in session a lot more. But what I thought was really interesting, Charlie, at the recent McMurtry lecture was that you pointed out that while he was willing to push the envelope on his executive powers when it came to war making and the suspension of habeas corpus, then when it came to slavery, he took it exactly the opposite perspective. He felt the Constitution did not give him the power to abolish slavery where it existed. And when people came and asked him to do so, he delayed for a long time, didn't he?
Well, he said, I don't have the authority to do that. I can't violate. So here, he can't violate the Constitution. But yet Lincoln had always said that he was morally and ethically opposed to slavery. In fact, he says that he had always hated slavery, and he could not remember when he did not hate slavery. But yet, when it comes to exercising extraordinary power, which he does in these other cases, as we mentioned, he could he have then emancipated the slaves or freed them all? And why does he wait to 63 to issue the final Emancipation Proclamation when it and his answer would have been and was that I don't have the power to do that. And even the Emancipation Proclamation, when he issued, he exempted a number of slave states from the Emancipation Proclamation. Maryland, Kentucky, Tennessee, Missouri were all specifically named as being excluded.
Well, that brings
from the
up
provisions of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Well, that brings up an old story I've heard, and I'll ask you if there's any truth to it. I heard that a group of abolitionists came to him. They might have been ministers, and said, Mr. President, if you abolish slavery throughout the loyal states and those states you've just mentioned, the Lord will be on your side. And his response was supposedly, I'd love to have the Lord on my side, but I must have Kentucky.
Well, actually, that was early in the war, and it didn't relate necessarily, specifically to slavery. What Lincoln was responding to there was the Kentucky declared itself as by the way, our speaker spoke to this sort of indirectly when he was talking about Tennessee, Sam Elliott, when he was talking about Tennessee declaring its independent, making itself an independent nation, and then joining the Confederacy. Kentucky did a similar thing. They declared themselves neutral in the war. And not on either side of the conflict. Well, when Kentucky did that, Lincoln was then asked to support the Union side of that. And he said, well, he decided to leave it alone because he had to have Kentucky because Kentucky was the headwaters of all of the river networks that flowed into the South.
Right.
The Ohio, the Tennessee, the Mississippi, all of those. And that's why, from a strictly a strategic, military strategic point of view, he had to have Kentucky. It was not about the social issue of slavery. But if he had done that in Maryland, for example, freed the slaves, or Kentucky, it is likely that those states would have gone over to the Confederacy in a big way, because one of the things Lincoln tried to do to free the slaves was he put forward a bill to Congress to compensate slave owners to emancipate their slaves. Well, the bill died in Congress because the states that were loyal to the Union that were still slave states, Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, Missouri, still had representatives in Congress. They all voted against compensated emancipation because they didn't want their slaves to be free.
Right. Well, it suggests to me then that this is very much an ethical issue, but that Lincoln was coming down on the side of practicality. If you look at a map, you see that Washington, D.C. is pretty much surrounded by either Maryland or Virginia. Virginia, of course, was part of the Confederacy. Maryland was still technically loyal.
Western Virginia, too, you see.
Yeah.
Western Virginia is another interesting constitutional dilemma, isn't it? Because West Virginia is going to secede from Virginia, And the Constitution says it can't do that without consent of Virginia.
We've done a whole episode on that, and that's a very interesting question as to whether the entire state of West Virginia is even constitutional. But my point is this, is that Lincoln seems to have been guided by necessity in all of these things. First of all, he assumed all of these war powers because he felt himself and the capital city under direct threat, both from the front and from the rear in Maryland. But similarly, he didn't stretch his powers when it came to emancipation and other related issues because he couldn't afford to go too far offending border states like Kentucky and Maryland.
Well, that's right. And he said, really goes a long ways. For example, when he has look at Fremont, General Fremont in Missouri, St. Louis, when he takes over the military district there, he immediately issues an order to emancipate the slaves. Lincoln overrules him and says, if an order to emancipate the slaves is to be issued, I will be the one to do it. You don't have the authority to do it, General.
Right.
And so he did the same thing with General Hunter in South Carolina.
It seems fair to say, then, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Charlie, that while Lincoln was certainly a very ethical man and a very good man, that he was also a practical politician, and that when it suited him, he stretched his powers. When it suited him, he hid behind the Constitution. And so we're going to be able to debate his ethics pretty much forever.
Well, I think we can always do that. But I don't think when we talk about ethics, we have to equate that a little bit to justice, don't we?
Yeah, I think we do.
Lincoln was in pursuit of justice. And Lincoln wanted to be just and fair. Now, he had American citizens who were property owners, in a sense. It's a terrible way to say this, but slaves were considered property, right? Mm-hmm. And the Constitution, to deprive these American citizens of their property without due process, is antithetical to private property ownership. I mean, capitalism, our country can't exist, really, with our economic structure, without the protection of private capital.
What,
and that means property.
What a mess, Charlie. But I wish we had more time, because you did a great job of elucidating issues at the recent McMurtry Lecture. And I would really appreciate your having done so. And thanks for coming on and talking to us today.
Oh, I'm glad to do it. Anytime.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Sam D. Elliott, the speaker at this year's 2017 R. Gerald McMurtry Memorial Lecture, who told us all about how Tennessee was readmitted to the Union and what a lengthy and fascinating process that was. Thanks also to Dr. Charles Hubbert, whom we just spoke to, all about some of the ethical and constitutional dilemmas that Abraham Lincoln faced during the prosecution of the Civil War. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our production intern is Donald Crenshaw. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check him out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, even if you might think of leaving from time to time.